From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. According to polls, one in four Americans didn't read a book last year. You could take that as good news. 75% of us read at least a book a year. Or bad news. A quarter of all Americans are living without books. Whether or not American literacy is in decline, one thing's for sure. American reading habits are definitely changing.
They are reading online. They are IMing all over the place. But it would appear they're reading less well.
We've lowered our standards of reading tremendously just in the last 20, 30 years. It has been a scary thing to watch.
In this hour, what to make of reading in the age of computers. And a celebration of the old-fashioned library. Alberto Manguel takes us on a guided tour of his personal library of 30,000 books. And a legendary children's book editor on what's wrong with a lot of kids' books today.
They're just what my husband used to call DCBs, darling children's books, with a very definite curl of the lip. They don't have an emotional truth, and they aren't something that I think kids would want to hear again and again and again and again.
Those stories a little later this hour. But first, Marianne Wolfe is one of the world's foremost experts on reading. A cognitive neuroscientist and scholar of reading, she teaches child development at Tufts University. She's also the author of Proust and the Squid, The Story and Science of the Reading Brain. When we went to her for help figuring out what's happening to reading in America, she told Anne Strainchamps there is some reason to worry.
What they're finding is, unfortunately, that especially our middle school and our teenage adolescents are not reading as much for pleasure as in the past. And by pleasure, we mean books, newspapers, things like that. They are reading online. They are IMing all over the place. But it would appear they're reading less well. And that's what I call deep reading, those deeper comprehension processes, like being able to infer, being able to bring our knowledge to bear on something. Those comprehension processes do appear to be either flattening or declining in our older youth. So that is a great cause of concern.
So you're not just talking about whether they can recognize vocabulary words or not. Mm. It's something more complex than that.
Oh, indeed. It's really what the brain does after it understands a word or it can perceive and decode it. It's all the richness, the texture of what makes us a thinking species. When you read, you're actually invoking quite a complicated circuit in your brain. And the first part is relatively simple. But then when we read fluently, we have what I consider almost miraculous milliseconds in which we bring to bear all that we've read, all that we know about these words, all that we know about the topic. And when we're in this mode of deep reading, we go beyond the text.
Is there a difference, do you think, between reading a screen and reading a printed page? I mean, they're both reading, but is something different happening in the reader's mind?
There is a question that I know in my own life I've answered in the negative, and that is, do I read online in the same way that I read hard copy? And the answer for me is that I am reading for efficiency, for immediacy, for quick access to information. Am I reading at that deeper level? By and large, the answer is no.
Do you think maybe that's because of the kind of content we put on screens at the moment versus the kind of content you go to a book for?
It is in part the content, because if you look at what we're reading, it's often more superficial, things that we can quickly multitask with. That's a piece of it. Another piece, and Nicholas Carr, who wrote a wonderful article called Is Google Making Us Stupid, makes a very important point that often when we, let's say, Google something or look up information, the information we get is actually prioritized by the number of hits it has. There's a real worry that I have that our knowledge base is being sorted by popularity of hit rather than what is an adjudicated source of knowledge.
What about your... You're a neuroscientist, and you study what actually happens in the brain when we read. From what you know, what's happening when we read a book versus when we read a screen? I mean, do you think, for instance, you and my children, who are growing up in a completely digital world, will have brains fundamentally different somehow than ours?
I really feel that's one of the most important questions that all of us with children should be asking. The brain is plastic. We can only read because the brain is plastic. But what that also means is, for me, reader beware. We can learn to read in very superficial ways. We can have a group of children who are the best information gatherers, the best multitaskers when they read. But are they learning in their formation processes to go after the gold of reading? And that is a comprehension that is so deep and so multi-layered and full of the capacity to build new thoughts. Deep reading is another way of saying deep thinking, is another way of saying deep virtue, because when we reflect upon something, we are really making judgments a great deal of the time. And I worry about this entire young digital generation being so, in some ways, superficially smart and having access to all this knowledge, but not developing the tools for wisdom. We must discuss this.
I don't think there's a parent who doesn't worry about some of this, but I took some hope from reading your book and discovering that many of the same questions that parents are asking themselves, that people have been asking for centuries. Socrates, for instance, the great Greek philosopher, you have a fascinating discussion about his concerns at the birth of print culture, that print culture would ruin thinking.
Socrates didn't want us to read. He thought that youth would become deluded by the seeming permanence of print, to believe they'd found the truth when they'd only just begun. Well, what he was saying, I think, can also be a cautionary tale for us as we look at Google. Look at our kids. And I don't know about yours, but mine are older, and they're saying when they finish an essay, and I say, "Are you finished?" And they'll say, "Oh, yes, I Googled it. I know it all." Well, they don't know it all, and it worries me that they think they do. And so what Socrates was worried about was the short-circuiting of the process of going after the essence of truth of something and not being content with superficial knowledge. Well, here we are with a technology that gives us access to knowledge the likes of which Socrates could never have imagined. This is an unbelievable moment. It is a fantastic moment. But how we approach, how we deal with that knowledge demands the highest thought, our highest thinking. And I'm not sure we're giving it.
Marianne Wolfe directs the Center for Reading and Language Research at Tufts University. Her book on the science of reading, called Proust and the Squid, is just out in paper. Wolfe spoke with Anne Strangechamps. So when was the last time you read a book? As Jimmy Durante used to say,
"I'll never forget the day I read a book. It was contagious, 70 pages. There were pictures here and there, so it wasn't hard to bear. The day I read a book. It's a shame I don't recall the name of the book. It wasn't a history, I know, because it had no plot. It wasn't a mystery, because nobody there got shot. The day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm gonna do it again."
How do people who write books for a living feel about the news that people may be reading less? Well, not all of them are convinced it's true. Ursula Le Guin is a writer so celebrated the Library of Congress lists her as a living legend. Her science fiction classic, The Left Hand of Darkness, and her young adult Wizard of Earthsea novels have never been out of print since they were published decades ago. In her lifetime, Le Guin has published 20 novels, 13 children's books, 6 volumes of poetry, and too many essays and short stories to count. In a recent essay in Harper's Magazine called Notes on the Alleged Decline of Reading, Le Guin takes issue with the idea that books are on their way out. She told Steve Paulson that books are here to stay, even if reading them has never had mass appeal.
It's probably always been in bad shape. And these sort of cries of doom, you know, I was thinking, golly, 40, 50 years ago, were there really that many more readers and so on? Of course, television and the computer and all the little palm things, you know, that people go around attached to at this point, these take away from reading time and they offer an entertainment other than reading. But still, how many readers, real readers, have there ever been?
You don't think there were more readers back, I don't know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago?
I tell you what, I don't know if there were more readers when they were grown up. But in school, kids read a lot. That's one of the things I wrote about in that article. You look at a reader from 1910, you know, a fifth grade reader or something, and you go, wow. These kids were really learning how to read.
Those books were a lot more demanding than a 10th grader gets today.
And they had a lot of poetry in them. People learned to read whole novels, you know, instead of little bits and so on. We've lowered our standards of reading tremendously just in the last maybe 20, 30 years.
Why? Why do you think we've lowered our standards of reading?
Because we've lowered our standards of education. And we've lowered our respect for public education terribly in my lifetime. And it has been a scary thing to watch.
Let me turn this around and ask a question from the perspective of book publishing. You are also quite critical in this essay that you wrote about what has happened to publishers. You're kind of despairing, in fact.
Yeah, well, you know, most at least fiction writers are going through a sort of valley of despair here. Most editors, I feel so sorry for editors. Authors used to like to get together and rage at their editors, you know, but boy, we're on the same side of the fence now with the editors. And the editors and the authors are all being pushed around by the sales departments and the accounting departments and the corporate owner and the great big chain bookstore. These large capitalist entities that run publishing much more closely than they used to do. And I don't think it's been really, really very good for publishing.
When you say editors and authors are getting pushed around, are you mainly talking about which books are accepted?
Yeah. This sort of general idea that an author's next book has got to sell better than the last one, that a book is not worth printing unless it's going to sell a lot of copies. So therefore, what's called the mid-list, the book that sells, you know, 20,000 copies, that's not worth publishing anymore. Everything sort of has to be instant bestseller. And the whole concept of a book being a bestseller very slowly over decades is kind of forgotten because it's the profit has to be instant. It has to be this quarter.
And there's not enough shelf space in the bookstore to let a book linger for months.
There always was until this kind of glut of things that are supposed to sell instantly. It's a very complicated thing, you know, but there are some very worrying trends in it. And one of them is this idea that a book is kind of like a magazine, that publishers aren't supposed to keep it in print. And gee, you know, a writer like me takes that very personally because the thing about my books is they do stay in print. There's quite a few of them have been in print for 40 years, never been out. I don't best sell, but I keep selling. Mm-hmm. Well, a publisher who can't handle that idea is, they should be doing something else, I think.
Well, the point that you're making is really subversive. I mean, you're saying that book publishers should not be driven by the need for ever-expanding profits, that there's nothing wrong with actually selling the same number of copies year after year. I mean, you're questioning the very capitalist system that we live under.
You are surprised. this is not the first time I've questioned capitalism.
Or you're saying that at least it should not apply to the world of books.
That's right, which is really all that I know about. You know, I don't know anything but books and housekeeping sort of. So that's all I can talk about. But yes, I do truly think publishers really didn't used to expect to make a lot of money. You know, they always hoped to. But it was not the expectation. The expectation was to have some good, solid books that kept selling and maybe a bestseller now and then. And with the profits of that, you plowed them back in on publishing some young writer who your editor just came and said, she's never going to sell, but she's tremendous, you know. That is getting so hard now. It's very hard to be a young writer now. It's hard to break in.
What do you make of the people who are predicting that the printed book will disappear because everything will go digital?
I'm too old to ask that question of. I think that the book or the printed page is such a handy, beautiful little piece of technology. I don't see why it should vanish in favor of something flickering on a screen. I don't see why one technology should drive out the other. They don't do quite the same thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And the fact is we really seem not to know how well any of our new technologies, the discs and so on, how well they're going to last. We know how long a book can last. If it doesn't get wet and it doesn't get burned, a well-made book is going to last centuries. And that's important. But then, you know, there are these also cross-technologies which seem to get forgotten, like print-on-demand, which involves both the computer and the book, right?
Right.
Print-on-demand may be kind of the way we do our books. It would make sense to me. Those who want to read on the screen can read on the screen. Those who want to read off a page can have a page. And the library can have a book, a physical book to put away on a shelf and keep. And I do think that's important.
Ursula Le Guin's essay on reading appeared in Harper's Magazine in 2008. Le Guin is the author of more than 20 award-winning science fiction and fantasy novels, including, most recently, Lavinia. Steve Paulson spoke with her. Next, a book so indestructible it survived the Spanish Inquisition, the Holocaust, and a civil war. The story of the Sarajevo Haggadah, after this. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The Sarajevo Haggadah is one of the most remarkable books in the world, for its staying power, if for nothing else. A rare illuminated Jewish manuscript, its origins are mysterious. It was created sometime in the middle of the 14th century, during the Golden Age of Spain, but was then lost for hundreds of years. It survived the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, the fires of the Inquisition in the 1600s, Nazi stormtroopers in 1941, and the Siege of Sarajevo in 1992. Writer Geraldine Brooks found the manuscript so inspiring she created a fictional version of its history in her novel People of the Book. She says she herself first heard about it when she was covering the Bosnian War.
I was working as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal at the time, and I was in Sarajevo. And at that point, the book was missing, and nobody knew what had happened to it. And the ultranationalist Serbs had been shelling the libraries and the museums of Sarajevo, trying to wipe out the record that a multicultural society had thrived there for so many centuries. And some people assumed that the book had been lost, and others said, no, no, Mossad came and rescued it. And others said, no, no, the Muslim government sold it on the black market to buy arms. And it turned out that none of those stories was true, and the truth was even more interesting, which was that a Muslim librarian had risked his life early in the war and gone into the museum and cracked the safe where the book was kept and taken it to safety.
It's an astonishing story. There is a description in the postscript of the library being shelled. For those who love books, it's a horrifying thought to think about all of those pages going up in smoke.
was 90% of the collection of the National Library of Bosnia was destroyed by phosphorus bombs, and the 10% of the books and manuscripts that were saved was just because of the heroism of the librarians and the citizens of Sarajevo who made a human chain to bring those to safety. But one of the librarians was actually killed in that effort.
You saw the library after the bombing had taken place. What did it feel like to be there?
Oh, it's the most desolate place in the world. It's a beautiful, fanciful Moorish building. And the outside of it is still intact, but the inside is completely rubble. And when I was there, it still stank of wet, burned pages. And there's a wonderful cellist in Sarajevo who very bravely would go and play Requiem at any site where snipers killed Sarajevan civilians, and he went to the library, and there's an incredibly moving picture of him sitting in these ruins playing a Requiem for the books.
This book seems to have had a powerful effect on everybody who came in contact with it. It must have been fascinating to think about the places it had been and the people who had held it.
Yeah, there's very little that we know for sure about the history of the book back before it emerged into public recognition in the 1890s. And that was when an indigent Jewish family in Sarajevo offered it for sale. And at that time, Bosnia was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So the book was immediately sent to Vienna for evaluation and hailed as a masterpiece. But back before that, we can't know very much. We know it was in Venice in 1609, and we know that because a Catholic priest named Domenico Vistorini wrote that there was nothing heretical against the Catholic Church, and he wrote that on the flyleaf, and he signed his name and dated it. And we know that Vistorini was a censor working for the Pope's Inquisition in Venice at that time. And we know it was created in Spain. How? Just because of the illuminations themselves. They're obviously depicting Spanish towns and Spanish costume of a period sometime after 1350. But who the artist was, we have no idea. Who the Jewish scribe or sofer who wrote the text in beautiful calligraphy, we don't know who he was either. So that's where you have the room to let your imagination work.
One of the interesting things about it is how this book seems to cross divides between religions. As you say, it was saved from destruction during the Bosnian War by a Muslim. That appears to have happened earlier as well. Is that true of the real volume, or is that just part of the story?
No, that is true. We know that the real volume was saved at least twice by Muslim hands. The first time that we know about was during World War II, and it was very dramatic. A Nazi general had come to the museum to demand the Haggadah. We think for a particular project of the Führer's, he had in mind to have a museum of the extinct race that he was going to have established in Prague. So after all the Jewish people had been wiped off the map of Europe, there would be a little sort of Jewish Disneyland tourist attraction. And he had saved three buildings in what had been the thriving Jewish quarter of Prague for this purpose. And he was filling them up with the best looted Judaica from the great collections of Europe. And it's thought that the Haggadah was destined for that.
It's a horrible thought, isn't it? It's one of those little details that makes the bigger horror more clear.
Oh, the depravity of it is just mind-bending. But in any case, the Haggadah was never handed over to General Fortner because the Muslim librarian in charge of the collection told his director at the museum that since the book was in his care, he was not going to surrender it. So he tucked it into the waistband of his trousers and he pulled his coat over it. And because he was the linguist on the staff of the museum, he went to translate the conversation between the general and his boss. And the conversation went like this. The general demands the Haggadah, and the librarian, Dervish Korkut, says, "I'm so sorry, Herr General, but you must know that one of your officers was here just several days ago, and he demanded it from us, and of course we surrendered it to him." And the general, turning puce, I imagine, says, "Name the man." And quick as a flash, the librarian replies, "Oh, sir, we didn't think it was our place to demand a name."
Again,
and that's true.
Those details that make the story real. The German general must have thought that there were so many looters in the army at that time that one of them might well have worked for him and come for the book.
Well, it's been well documented in some fantastic studies that the Nazis were just kleptocrats of a very high order. And there was never, I think, a more systematic looting than what took place in Europe.
There is a kind of repetitive anti-Semitism to the trials that the Haggadah has to go through. I suppose every age turns to some extent on religious conflict, but this Haggadah seems to have gone through many and survived. Is that oddly a source of hope in your mind?
I'm kind of an incurable optimist, even though the evidence is so overwhelmingly to the contrary. And I think, you know, we are at risk of skidding into another one of these periods where we allow these wonderful, prosperous, diverse societies that we've created, where we're all enriched by appreciating each other's difference, to be held down by xenophobic forces and haters of otherness.
It's odd to talk to someone who has seen as much of the ill the world is capable of as you have as a correspondent, to hear you describe yourself as an optimist.
Well, for all the ill that you see as a correspondent, I also saw amazing occasions where catastrophe brought people to their best self, to selves they maybe never even knew were contained within them. And I'm thinking particularly of women that I got to know in the Middle East and in Africa, women who were taught to think that their lives would be completely circumscribed and entirely domestic. And then catastrophe befalls them, whether it's famine or a war or a political crackdown, and the men are somehow gone. And the women have no choice but to step up and save their families. And I saw women do the most extraordinary things. And I also witnessed unbelievable acts of kindness from warriors who in another context might be required to behave with great brutality. And yet people could be incredibly unselfish in these times of horrible conflict. So I think that you see, you know, it's a cliche to say the best and worst of human nature, but you really do.
So for every library with 90% of its books burned, there is a cellist somewhere who will play a requiem.
One hopes.
Geraldine Brooks is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of March and, most recently, People of the Book. No one appreciates a library more than the writer and critic Alberto Manguel. As a boy, he organized his picture books by subject matter. He grew into a young man with a voracious reading habit whose books quickly outgrew his shelf space. As an adult, he's still at it. He's written dozens of essays about books, and his personal collection now numbers in excess of 30,000 volumes, and it's still growing. Recently, Manguel settled in a small village in the south of France, where he converted an old stone barn into the library of his dreams. He writes about it in a new book called The Library at Night. He told Anne Strainchamps that we all have a dream of a perfect library.
Some readers like well-lit libraries, and some like libraries that are towers, like Montaigne's, or others prefer libraries in several rooms. My notion of a perfect library was this very, very long room with dark wood shelving and a low light. So some people find it rather gloomy, but I like the fact that especially at night, my book is called The Library at Night for a particular reason, the reading seems more concentrated.
You have some beautiful descriptions of what it means to you to live with your books, and especially those times at night when you're alone with them. Why do you love reading at night so much?
I think reading at night allows me greater freedom. During the day, because I see the library so much more clearly and I know the order in which the books stand, in the case of my library, they have been ordered by the language in which the books were written and then in alphabetical order, and then, of course, dozens of exceptions. At night, because my concentration is not so great and I allow my mind to wander, I am more responsive to the chaos of books, to the associations that books affect between one another, and the suggestions that an open page can make. One of my favorite librarians, one of the chapters of The Library at Night is dedicated to him, Abby Warburg, who was the eldest son of a family of Jewish bankers in Hamburg at the beginning of the 20th century. He discovered a series of laws or rules of the library, and one of my favorite ones is the law of the good neighbor, which says that the information you're looking for in a book is always in the book next to it.
I love this idea of the library as this place that's kind of a borderland right on the frontier between order and chaos, between what's known and what is mysterious. The photo on the dust jacket of your book conveys that so beautifully.
Isn't it a wonderful photograph that Yale University Press came up with that image, the idea of somebody reading in the middle of a forest, so that you have the notion of the wilderness and the darkness and the chaos that is the universe in which we find ourselves, and then the order of the man reading at a desk, which is what a library tries to do. In fact, the starting point of The Library at Night was this question: why is it, if what we know of the universe is its madness, its lack of sense, its chaotic nature, do we believe that the bits and pieces that we have collected of the universe and put into books can have an order, can have a numerical or alphabetical order that will make sense to us? I am moved by the optimism that we show when we build the library.
You know, part of your book is this meditation on the idea of library, and you kind of trace it back through history. What do you think it is behind that human ambition to collect all? Is it about immortality, about wanting to preserve ourselves?
My guess is that it belongs to our nature as human beings, that we come into the world as reading animals. That is to say, there is an impulse in us because we are animals conscious of ourselves. There is an impulse to decipher the world as if the world were a text laid in front of us, and we should be able to understand what it says. And so with this ambition of wanting to know what the story of the world is, we try to collect everything that has been written about the world in order to find that secret phrase, page, book that will reveal the answers to our questions.
Have you found, as you've kind of delved into the history of libraries, and especially personal libraries, have you found particular creators of libraries in history whom you in some sense recognize? You know, you feel yourself to be in some way part of their lineage?
Well, the man I mentioned, Abby Warburg, is for me the uttermost creative librarian, because he set his library up according to the way in which he associated books. So it was a library that no one else could use because he didn't understand the order.
How did he arrange them?
Well, he would associate one book with another in his own mind. The biography of a painter could remind him of a certain exploration in Africa, and so the book on Africa would go next to that, and that would remind him of certain African masks, and so a book on masks would be next to that. And
sounds like the library as poem.
The library as mind, I would say, or the mind as poem, in that you compose the library according to the way in which you think so that it becomes a reflection of your own self. In the case of Warburg, this was true to the point that when he was convinced by his assistants to open the library to the public, to turn it into a public library, he lost his mind. That in losing his library as a private place, he began to suffer psychically, and it took a very long time for him to be cured.
Do you do this with your own books and sort of play with them, arrange them, and rearrange them?
Oh, yes. For instance, just give you one example. I found in a flea market a copy of writer no one reads today called Volney, a book called Ruins of Empire, and I put it next to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Why? Because Frankenstein's monster learns to read listening to someone read to his children Volney's Ruins of Empire. It's a very, very unlikely thing. but in my mind, you see, they go together.
Of course, I think you quote Jonathan Swift had a story about books after hours fighting with each other.
Well, this is, I think, an ongoing imagination that readers have. What happens to the books at night? In the library at night, I try to imagine some of these scenarios. And I think that it is a little like children who, on going to sleep, imagine what happens to the toys in their bedroom, what happens to these objects that they have collected, what happens to them once they drift into dreams, what is the dream life of books. I think that books become contaminated or tinged with the personality of their readers, and that in a certain sense a library is a reader's autobiography. You could go through the books in my library and guess what my life has been. In fact, I once imagined what fun it would be to go into someone's house, someone you don't know, and then try to reconstruct that person's life through the books on their shelves.
So do you ever sit in your library at night and imagine that the books all around you are silently whispering to each other?
Most nights the library is haunted by these ghosts, but they're friendly ghosts and they're instructive ghosts. I love to be in the library at night because it allows me not to read in some cases, just to stay with a book, stay with a certain sentence or paragraph, and just reflect. A library is not only a place for active reading, it is also a place for reflection. And in the world that we have built today, in which we have not left space for silence, for reflection, even for conversation, the library remains one of those few sanctuaries for real intellectual pursuits.
Alberto Mangel's books on reading include A Reading Diary, A History of Reading, and, most recently, The Library at Night. Anne Strangeham spoke with him.
Just a baby, before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal numbered shelf to every decimal numbered spine. I'm alive.
Jonathan Runman from his CD Public Library. Next, generations of children fell in love with books and reading thanks to Danny and the Dinosaur, the Little Bear books, and Lily's Purple Plastic Purse. We'll meet the woman behind them all after this.
I'm a librarian.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Little Bear's Visit by Elsa Homelund Manarik. Pictures by Maurice Sendak.
What was the very first book you fell in love with? The first printed page you could read all by yourself, one stubby finger tracing the letters as you sounded them out. If you learned to read any time in the last 40 years or so, chances are good Susan Hirschman had something to do with it. The legendary children's book editor and founder of Greenwillow Books, Hirschman shepherded a veritable who's who of children's book authors into print. Jack Brelutsky, the children's poet laureate. Kevin Henkes, Virginia Hamilton, Peter Cease. Now retired, Hirschman recently gave Steve Paulson a whirlwind tour of her picture book collection.
Well, I made a pile of some of the things that I liked best when I was little. And the wonderful thing is that they look like new, and more important than that they look like new is they read like new. There's Bemelman's Madeline, which there's an inscription in it. I apparently got it in 1940. There's James Doherty's Andy and the Lion, Bemelman's Hansi. There are lots and lots of them. And I think the important thing is that a good book is a good book. It doesn't matter when it was written. If kids liked it then, they're probably going to like it now.
The rest of us have our favorites of the books that we've loved over the years, especially those that we loved as children. But what are some of the secrets of making a great children's book?
I think it's emotional veracity, truth, and having something to say that's worth saying, that has a real emotional content, because after all, emotions don't change over the years. And I think that what's the matter with a lot of books is that they're just what my husband used to call DCBs, darling children's books, with a very definite curl of the lip. But they don't have an emotional truth. And I think there are so many empty picture books where you if you have to read it again and again, it's like reading the telephone book. It's not very interesting. There is no poetry. There is no pattern. There is no rhythm.
Well, let's go back to some of these books that you picked out from your own childhood. For instance, a Bemelman book, Madeline. Many people are familiar with that. My own daughter grew up loving Madeline. Tell me about what makes that book work.
Well, I think in Madeline, she's such a real character. She's not afraid of ice. She loved the winter snow and ice. And she says poo-poo to the tiger. And every kid likes to read about a kid like that, a bad kid. And then she wakes up in the middle of the night crying. She has appendicitis. Something terrible happens. It all ends happily. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's about something. And you believe in her. And I think that's why it's lived. Of course, the pictures are wonderful. But the story is a forever story.
Now, you have some other books that you have also picked out as perfect picture books. Tell me about the next one.
Well, the next book is Kevin Henkes's A Good Day. Kevin started publishing with us when he was 18. And he came into Greenwillow, and he looked about 11. And I said to him, why did your mother let you come to New York alone? And he said, she cried. And so after I'd read his first book, manuscript, I called his mother and said, he's all right. He's here. We've taken his book. But that was a long, long time ago. And he's gone on to write wonderful novels for older kids and picture books. He won the Caldecott a few years ago. And this perfect book in front of me is A Good Day. And the words and the pictures are absolutely seamless. And what more could you ask, except maybe to read it again?
Sometimes I know the role of an editor can be to inspire. And I know you've, I mean, I've heard stories about some of the writers you've worked with. For instance, Jack Prelutsky, the poet.
Well, he came in, I think, at the time, it was in the early 60s, and he wanted to be an illustrator, but he had to have something to draw, and so he wrote some poems so that he could illustrate them. And I think I thought the pictures were terrible, but I loved the poetry. And I guess I told him as much. I don't think he was surprised. And so he went on to become the first children's poet laureate of this country last year, which is good.
But the story is even more interesting than that, because you induced him to write those poems early on. I mean, he was poor, he was struggling, and didn't you often take him out to lunch?
I took him out to lunch. Macmillan in those days had an executive dining room, and Jack was not making a great deal of money at the time, and I think he was often quite hungry. And so I said if he'd bring us a poem every Friday, I'd take him up to the executive dining room for lunch. And he brought a poem every Friday, not so much because I think he wanted to get the book out, but because he wanted to have lunch. But the worst thing I did to him, he was a very generous man then and now, and he got his $500 advance, and before he could do anything sensible with it, like put it in the bank, he'd lent it to his friends who were even poorer than he. And so on his next contract, I said to him, all right, we're going downstairs to the bank, and we're going to open a joint checking account, and you can come in once a week and take money out of it, but not without my signature. And that poor man agreed. And for quite a long time, we had a joint checking account. And when he wanted money, he needed me. And so he ate better that period.
You have, over the course of your career, had an influence on many of the books that have become part of our culture. And I have to tell you that probably my very favorite book as a child growing up was Watership Down by Richard Adams. And you knew him.
Yeah, in 1972, I guess, I was in London on business and staying with my friend Julia McCrae, who was the children's book editor then at Hamish Hamilton. And she said to me, have you seen this new book that everyone's talking about here called Watership Down? And I said, no. And she said, well, it's a 400-page novel about rabbits. And I thought, well, I can live without that. And the next day, Julia said to me, did you do anything about Watership Down? And I said, no. And when I was getting ready to come back to America, having done all my good business, Julia presented me with a copy of Watership Down and said, I really think you ought to read this. And I read it all the way home on the plane. And I didn't quite finish it. And I went to work on the Lexington Avenue bus the next day. And I had a few pages left to go. And I finished it. And great wet book tears were falling down my face. I think book tears are wetter than normal tears. And I got to work. And we made a very small offer. I think it was a $2,000 advance. And they accepted it. And I thought, it's not going to be every kid's cup of tea, but over the next few years, we'll certainly sell 10,000 copies, and it will stay in print, and it's a very good book, and it certainly deserves to be in print in the United States. But people began reading it around the department and talking, and word spread, and they decided that it wasn't just a children's book, that adults would like it. And it was felt then, and I think probably correctly, that if it was published as an adult book, it would come down to kids and be available to kids. But if it was published as a children's book, it wouldn't go up to adults.
I want to pick up on what you were talking about with Watership Down and the crossover
readership between adults and kids, because I mean that's obviously a big thing now. I mean, we know that best from Harry Potter, but a number of other fantasy books, more and more adults are reading these books that ostensibly were for kids. And to me, that suggests how much the world of children's books has changed, because my sense is that that was really ghettoized at one point. That was sort of the poor division of a publishing company, but that it seems to be quite different now.
Yes, I think Harry Potter did an awful lot of wonderful things for reading in general, and making reading cool to kids and making kids' books cool to adults. God knows all of us had tried to do both those things for all our working lives. Kids' books at their best are awfully, awfully good and span any age category. And I don't think that they're as widely read by adults. For the Little House books, for instance, are wonderful reading for adults, but I don't think many adults are reading them. I know when my husband gave them to his mother, they went all around her community. And when people are lucky enough to be introduced to a children's book as a book, they like it. But I don't think that the back and forth is as broad as it might become. It's better than it was, absolutely. And nobody apologizes for reading Harry Potter.
Susan Hirschman spent nearly 50 years at the forefront of children's book publishing as an influential editor and founder of Green Willow Books. Steve Paulson spoke with her. And we couldn't let this hour end without a little Elvis. I'm giving you a long look every day. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to purchase a copy of this hour, please call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for The Library Show, number 928A. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Ann Strainchamps, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. We always like to know what you think of our programs. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We look forward to hearing from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.